Welcome to Windrush What's Next? The Struggle for Justice, a brand new broadcast series which has been commissioned by the Black Cultural Archives to examine the aftermath of the Windrush scandal. This entire series was recorded and produced during lockdown and is funded by the Paul Hamlin Foundation. I am your host, Sinai Flary, and this series is dedicated to all Windrush survivors and the late Windrush campaigner, Paulette Wilson.
Windrush, what's next? The struggle for justice in memory of Paulette Wilson.
In this episode, we will be discussing the Windrush compensation scheme with lawyer Jacqueline McKenzie, Martin Ford QC, who is a barrister and the independent advisor for the Windrush compensation scheme, Minister Clive Foster, who is a senior minister at the Pilgrim Church in Nottingham, and Hilary Brown, who is the CEO at Virgo Consultancy Services Limited. Jackie, you've worked tirelessly with Windrush survivors. Can you tell us how the scandal has impacted some of the lives of your clients?
The Windrush scandal has impacted the lives of people that I'm working with and the wider Windrush generation community, so to speak, in many, many ways, really. I think the most important thing for me is that it shows that people who are from the Windrush generation and their descendants are possibly the least regarded people in British society. It's almost as though we're at the bottom of every pile, socioeconomically, culturally, politically, and we don't matter. And I say that because the scandal could have happened to another community, but essentially it has happened mainly to people of Caribbean origin. I know that there are people from the African community and people from the Indian community, or rather Asian community, and the wider Commonwealth community involved in this, but essentially it is something that affects the people who are actually the Windrushers, and those are Caribbean people. And I think why I say, why I make the point that I make is because 2 years on, we're pretty much in the same place that we were at the outset. Now, for me, the scandal has been going on for several decades. And, you know, one of the victims was upset to me actually started the minute people got off the boat. And we know that there was a big, you know, row about the boats docking in Tilbury in the first place. You know, Clement Attlee, who was the Prime Minister at the time, was petitioned by 11 MPs who wanted the boats to turn around and be sent to Africa, and that the people on the boat, who were free men and women, they weren't enslaved people, would go and work in a peanut plantation. So the problem started there. Then we had legislation in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, which compounded the fact that people who were born under a British flag, who were born as British citizens, not knowing anything else because constitutionally their countries didn't exist in the way that they are now post-independence, had their status stripped from them or were required to apply for status and didn't even know. Nobody told them. And the little bit of advertising that was done to make people aware was so limited that most people didn't know. And that's why we have the scandal. But 2 years on, the scandal is continuing. It's continuing because there are still people waiting for their status to be sorted out. There are still people being deprived of citizenship for very spurious reasons. And of course, we've got the compensation scheme, which is very problematic in that all it's really doing is compensating people for loss. It's not doing anything more than that. And there are problems with delay and tariffs, etc.
Yeah. What advice would you give to people who are still reluctant to make a claim? Because there's been, you know, highly publicized criticisms of the compensation scheme. But what advice would you give to people who may be still sitting there thinking it's not worth claiming?
Well, I think that's one of the problems with some of the criticism, because not all of the criticism of the scheme is valid. And a lot of it's just, you know, housing and various people sort of saying things that, and they haven't really studied the scheme properly. They're, you know, and so some of the criticism is unwarranted and problematic in that it is preventing people from claiming. They should at least consult one of the organisations. The BCA themselves run surgeries, which I run for them. But there are lots of, I'm not the only lawyer doing this. There are lots of lawyers around the country. There's lots of organisations. There's some very, very good Windrush groups around Windrush Justice in London, and there were organisations in Birmingham, Manchester, Nottingham, Preston, doing excellent work. And there is also the CA service that people can go to. Law centres are doing great work. People should just have a chat with somebody. You shouldn't take too much notice of the criticism, because, you know, there are things to criticise about the scheme, but a lot of the criticism is ill-informed. And if it's putting people off, then that's really problematic. People should make the claim they're entitled to do so.
Now, lastly, Jackie, what do you think the government and ministers can do to right the wrong Windrush scandal? I mean, we have a compensation scheme which is, you know, working in some parts, be improved in some ways. Also, we have a Windrush Day. Is that enough? What else can they do from your perspective?
I think really and truly, the Windrush scandal is about how people who came here thinking they were British, it was different from somebody moving from Liverpool to London. That's what they thought. And they've come here and they've worked in the most miserable of occupations. They've made their contribution. They've tried very hard with their descendants, and all sorts of problems have beholden their descendants, from the criminal justice system, the racism in that, to the problems we've had in education. Even now, it's contemporary, we're seeing the issue with the A-level results and how that's disproportionately affecting poorer people and people of African Caribbean descent disproportionately. So we have a problematic issue, or we have a major issue here that starts with the generation, our grandparents arriving and our parents arriving in this country and not being treated with equality or in the same way that other people have been treated. And I think really and truly what the government needs to do is twofold. They need to sort out the scandal. People need to get their status documents. People who are entitled to citizenship ought to be granted it. Compensation ought to be paid out quickly. Where it can't be paid out quickly, people should be given interim payments or made to benefit from the hardship fund, which I think works very poorly. I think the tariffs for impact on life need to be improved. I think all these issues about future loss of earnings, future loss of pensions, criminality, all of that needs to be ironed out. These are processes with the actual governance of dealing with the scandal. Those things need to be sorted. But the bigger issue for me is how people of African Caribbean descent are treated in society against all indexes that are used to measure quality of life and attainment, education, health, housing, business, criminal justice, immigration. I think there needs to be a proper commission looking at the inequalities and the racism that means that that community suffers much more than any other community in what is a modern and so-called civilized society. And all these little disparity groups and race groups and committees and commissions and reviews are one thing. They may tell us something useful. A lot of them don't tell us anything we don't know. But there needs to be a much far-reaching analysis of what is wrong with this society that could cause something like the scandal and could cause the ongoing problems that the community are beset with, and how do we address these? And it's, in a way, it's kind of like restoration, restorative justice, reparations, whatever we want to call it, but it has to feature. The scandal is a microcosm of a much, much bigger problem. And in order to resolve the scandal, they've got to address much bigger and far-reaching issues. The Windrush generation, and I am of that generation, you know, my parents came here in the 50s, I was born here in the 60s. What needs to happen is equality of opportunity and an end to the mistreatment and the discrimination, whether it's overt, whether it's because the system is structurally racist. Whatever the explanations are, there needs to be a resolution and some positive action so that people of these communities can attain equally alongside their peers. And until that happens, we have no justice.
Thank you, Jackie. A powerful point to end on.
Windrush, what's next? The struggle for justice in memory of Barlett Wilson.
My next guest is Martin Ford QC, who is a barrister and the independent advisor for the Windrush Compensation Scheme. Can you tell us about the role of Windrush Compensation Scheme? So, explain some of the misconceptions surrounding the scheme.
Yeah, of course. I'm a barrister. I specialise in clinical negligence law, which is one of the areas where you have to try and value claims when people suffer medical misfortune or accidents. And I was approached about trying to design the scheme, which I was very happy to do, not least, I mean, my parents came over from Barbados in 1953 and St. Lucia in 1955. And I felt very strongly that as a generation, they were not appreciated. And it was quite appalling that people found their status in this country questioned, which I'm afraid goes back to what I've described as the great con trick. My parents thought they were British when they came on their passport, but they then had to naturalise because we were never really granted fully British status when we were given citizens of the United Kingdom and colony status. So that, I think, caused an awful lot of confusion. Then there were lots of different rule changes in the 70s and 80s. So, for instance, if you're born in this country pre-83, you're automatically British. If you're born after 83, you're not. Then in 88, lots of people who had indefinite leave to remain stamped in their passport decided to go back to the Caribbean to retire, and they didn't realise that if they didn't come back for 2 years, their indefinite leave to remain lapsed and they could only come back as a visitor. So the rules are incredibly complicated. So my task was, first of all, to gather some evidence, which we did for a month. Then we consulted the affected communities for about 4 months. And then we got a pattern of the different types of suffering that people had sustained. So the ones that hit the headlines were things like detention and deportation, lack of access to NHS services, problems with housing, particularly social housing, where people couldn't prove their status, denial of benefits, which people were entitled to because they paid tax and national insurance for decades, and other issues around accessing public services. So we identified about 14 consistent types of loss, ranging from detention and deportation. There weren't too many cases, but there's some very troubling ones. Loss of employment, where people were asked by employers to produce evidence of their status and didn't have a British passport because they sometimes hadn't renewed their Caribbean passport and the employers wouldn't accept that. But then obviously some people, once they lost their jobs, were then denied benefits. Some people couldn't get driving licenses renewed. Some people then couldn't open bank accounts because they didn't have any valid ID. Some people who had pensions being paid into bank accounts found they couldn't access them. So it was a really, really concerning story. So there are 14 different types of claim that you can make, and in some cases they'll be interrelated. So you'll have people who were detained, were then on immigration bail, then lost their jobs, then couldn't access benefits. So those are all different types of claim. And then the one that's the hardest to calculate is what we've called impact on life. So that's the damage that's caused by the distress of being put through these processes. Or the additional distress of perhaps being detained and threatened with deportation or actual deportation. I think you ask about misconceptions. I think the biggest ones are probably as follows. The overall cost of the scheme is uncapped. There have been lots of suggestions it's capped at $200 million. It will cost what it costs. There were news reports saying that if you were deported, you would only receive £10,000, which again is wrong. The £10,000 for deportation is based upon what a court would award for the fact of deportation. But if being deported led to your loss of job and earnings or loss of access to benefits, that's all in place. So let's say you were earning $20,000 a year and you were out of the country for 3 years, you'd get your $60,000 loss of earnings plus your $10,000 deportation plus your impact on life. And then I realised that, you know, we have intergenerational closeness in our communities. And so if I were deported, my parents would have been very upset about it. So they would have an impact on family life. If I was deported and impecunious and they supported me from England by sending me money, then they can reclaim the money that they sent. If I was detained and they had in detention, they would get their incidental expenses, travel expenses related to coming to see me. And then, unfortunately, I realised that some of the cohort were quite elderly. So my dad actually passed in February, aged nearly 89. and I've provided that claims can be inherited. So you mentioned Paulette, an absolute tragedy and a quite phenomenal woman. I met her on a couple of occasions and I just felt humbled in her presence, and I was very upset to find that she passed. Her daughter, if she wishes to make a claim, would be able to inherit what Paulette would otherwise have been entitled to. And I guess the last thing, I think people have been very easily put off because there's been lots of suggestions that, you know, the form's 18 pages and it's all very complicated. The form is 18 pages, 13 and a half of them are blank to allow people to tell their stories, which is deliberate. And I think 2.5 pages are really just information, you know, proving who you are, what your national insurance number is, what your address is. If you've had a British passport or a Caribbean passport, give the passport number, checking that you've got the status to make the claim. And there is assistance available. The initial contract was given to Citizens Advice, so you could go to a Citizens Advice Centre, and they have been trained in how to fill in the forms and get the information that you will need. There's a procurement process out at the moment for assistance from potentially other organisations. I think the Home Office realised that we need a few more people from the community involved in the front line. But I'm really, really anxious that people don't think it's too complicated and they give up and don't make claims. I mean, the Home Office should pay for this scandal. And you know, I really would encourage people to make claims. And the scheme that's currently due to run to 2023, I think there might be some movement there because obviously getting money out and processing claims during COVID has been difficult. But I'm happy to say that I think over £1.5 million so far has been offered. And I'm certainly aware of two or three people who've received six-figure, over £100,000 by way of compensation. They're reluctant to publicise that that's happened. So you tend only to see the bad news stories in the media, which I think is a shame.
Fewer than 8% of Windrush victims claiming compensation have received payouts, and the scheme has come under great criticism. Do you think the scheme could be improved in any way?
Yeah, I mean, I'm interested in the 8% figure because that's the first time I've heard that. I think in terms of payment delay, the media again have been a little unfair. If this scheme, as I hope it will, delivers hundreds of millions of pounds worth of compensation, then it needs to be capable of sustaining rigorous scrutiny by the National Audit Office, the Taxpayers Alliance, etc. So I was appointed in April 2018. The scheme was designed within a year. So the first year of so-called delay, I think, really can't be attributed to a lack of action on the part of the Home Office. Then from April 2019, when it was announced, it took until December for the first payments to be made. And I'm aware that that is a reasonable period of time, but there needs to be recruitment of caseworkers. And that took about 6 months. I think that one of the issues is how information is presented. So the initial payments, I think, were 62,000. And everybody said, oh, you know, divide that by 15 people. We're all getting 3,000 each. That's not quite the case. What the Home Office did initially was to pay fees because they've got that on their database that people shouldn't have incurred. And then they look at detention because there's a formula, a course-proof formula for that. But the impact on life, the loss of earnings claims will take a little longer. But things are speeding up. What I'm hoping, although it's been a forlorn hope so far, is that if we can get some publicity about people who've received substantial payments, then the community will realise it is very worthwhile sitting down and going through the form. I also want the Home Office, in terms of improvement, to be light touch on documentation. We got into this scandal because people were, you know, the onus was put on individuals to produce documentation. I think the onus should be on the state to prove that you're not entitled to be here rather than you proving that you are. And I don't want the Home Office to fall into the same error of asking people for documentation, which has gone missing because, you know, if you lost your job 10 years ago, you won't have your payslip. But if you give them your national insurance number, the name of your employer, they should then go and do the digging. They have data agreements in place as a result of the scheme. whereby if you give basic information, they should be able to go back and then come back to you and say, this is what we think you were earning at the time. This is how much tax you were paying, national insurance. These are your pension contributions. We calculate you've lost this amount. Does that appear to be correct to you? And so I do feel that the burden in terms of paperwork should be reasonable. I don't think it should be onerous. I don't think people should be made to feel, you know, that they can't claim because they've lost paperwork. All of us have got an audit trail to prove that we were legitimately here. So in my parents' case, you know, GP records, their names on my brother's birth certificate, my birth certificate. It should therefore be possible, it seems to me, to show that you are legitimately here with legitimate claims and have been for some time.
Just repeat for us again when the deadline is for applying for the Windrush compensation scheme.
Yeah, at the moment it's been extended to the spring of 2023, and I think there are potential reasons for asking for a further extension, because as I've said, it was just getting going in terms of payments. So payments December, January, February, then we went into lockdown. That has impacted on the deliverability of the scheme a little, because if you're having to go to HMRC for tax records, for instance, they're under enormous pressure with things like furloughing. And they've also got a lot of people working from home as well. And documentation may be a bit harder to find in the current circumstances. But I am assured by the Home Office that they're making strenuous efforts to keep the scheme moving. And I was very encouraged. I think the figures in May were 1.5 million paid or offered. So it looks as if the payouts and offers are running at about £250,000 to £300,000 a month from a very low base. I accept that. But I really would encourage people to claim. Anybody who suffered any loss really must claim and make the Home Office pay. That's the whole idea of the scheme, is to make them pay for the appalling treatment of people that were legitimately in this country, who were law-abiding taxpayers, who made a massive contribution to the economy of this country, only to find that their right to exist in this country was effectively denied.
Absolutely. Martin, I could talk to you all day about this, but I do know you have to go. Thank you so much for joining me on Windrush, What's Next? The Struggle for Justice. I have been speaking to our special guest, Martin Ford, QC.
Thank you very much.
Windrush, What's Next? The Struggle for Justice, in memory of Barlett Wilson.
Joining me now, Clive Foster, Senior Minister at the Pilgrim Church in Nottingham. Hi, Clive.
Hi.
When were you made aware that immigration policies were having a direct impact on those who were attending your church, and how did you support them through this awful time?
Well, we were seeing things in the 2000s, probably from 2008 and 2009. More and more people from our own church were coming to the senior ministers about the immigration issues that they were having. We are predominantly a majority Black-led church, and we were seeing people, particularly from Jamaica background, who were saying that they were having issues in terms of having to, prove their status. We were getting hints from senior members who were saying, look, I've got a family member, and they are concerned about some issues about they're in the country. So what was happening was, we would have people who were members of our church, been here, worked over here for so many years in the country, then getting a letter saying that they had to leave the country and come back even. We had instances like that. And even my own sister, who lives in Jamaica, she's a head teacher. She was working over in Jamaica. And when my mother died in 2015, she wanted to come over. She'd been over before, so many years before, but for some reason in 2015, she couldn't come over. The access to get her over just didn't happen. So we were beginning to see an increase. These were individual issues. So we weren't like connecting the dots, as it were. But we noticed that families were being separated. So one of the things that we had to do with the church is that we had to, as it were, support people emotionally who were being separated and torn apart. And so we did that through, you know, meeting with people, trying to console them, trying to help them get through painful separations as well.
Now, I mean, you said that you supported them. Did you do things like surgeries to try and provide them with some advice, legal advice? Did you get legal experts in to try and advise them as well? If you can tell me a bit more about that.
So one of the first things that we did is that when people came to us about their issues, you know, they were traumatized. So we tried to console them and give them confidence. And the second thing that we did was we tried to provide and support them through the legal process. So we have had and still do have relationships with legal advisors in Nottingham. And so we could direct them individually to get their legal support and advice to progress their cases, as it were. And so it was based on having those relationships as a church and as a community that we were able to direct people to get the legal support. Unfortunately, sometimes people were being failed through the legal system for one reason or another. And we was able on a few occasions just to direct people to legal support whereby they could get the, as it were, the next steps that they needed to take legally to help them in the situation that they found themselves in.
I know the Windrush Compensation Scheme launched in April 2019. What was the overall response to the scheme from people that you've spoken to? And, I mean, did you provide any help with those who were wishing to claim compensation?
Well, we moved very quickly to engage in the compensation scheme. I mean, when it came out in terms of the consultation process, as a local church, we encouraged people to participate in that process. And when the compensation scheme was actually launched, we held surgeries. We set up surgeries whereby we invited members of the church and the community to come forward. We also had expert legal advice present as well to deal with it. We felt that as we explained the compensation scheme in the early days, we tried to explain that clearly, concisely, and we really wanted to reinforce the legitimacy that people had because of the way that they were treated and the indignity that they had to suffer, that they had a right to actually make a compensation claim. So initially, and when we set up these surgeries, people responded positively in actually wanting to pick up an application form, compensation form, and to engage. I think that was our experience. I have to say that sadly, when it moved to the next stage in terms of hearing from the Home Office, and engaging through that route, there was a lack of information, a lack of hearing back from them. And I think this affected people's confidence with regards to the compensation scheme going forward. But any time that we put on a session, it was well attended. People seemed to respond. But it was the support through the process, which I think was and still is a challenge for people to continue with.
We've had numerous stories, the form being too long and it's too complicated. And, you know the scheme has come under great criticism, small payouts. How do you think the scheme could be improved just from your position as a senior minister and helping your through the process? How do you think it can be improved?
Well, I think one of the things that needs to be done is needs to be more investment at grassroots level for people who can actually advocate for the scheme and advocate in a way whereby they know the people who they're engaging with and that they can support them with. Look, I'm not afraid to say, if you're going to say to me, you can get hundreds of pounds, Clive, I'll say yes. And you say to me, you have to fill it in form. I might think, oh, well, that's another thing to do. And so, you know, the whole concept of just, you know, filling in a form, there needs to be a supported process. And we also know that there's no legal support for people as well. So to unpack this whole, we've got to look at this as more of a package. It's not just a form-filling exercise. It's an whole package here of support that needs to be invested in.
Our church is at the heart of the Black community in the UK. It's considered a safe haven, a place where people come to uplift themselves and feel great. What has the Windrush scandal done to the spirits and the morale of those attending your church, Pilgrim Church in Nottingham?
Well, I think it's reminded us of the great heritage and history that we have as a people, not only our spiritual heritage, but the heritage that we came over from the 50s and 60s to rebuild the country. It's reminded us as a church of the importance of our rights, our human rights to be here, and given us a confidence that we can participate in the social ills and bring about social change. So we can act as transformational agents rather than just being, you know, backseat spectators of something happening to us. And I think the mere fact that we said, no, this is not right. We can't be just treated like this. We want to see something done right against the scandal. I think it's helped the church to engage even wider with the community as well.
How do you think the Windrush generation should be honoured in the UK? We've had talks about, you know, a statue and memorials. How would you like to see that generation remembered and celebrated in the UK?
Well, I think statues and memorials are important. One of the things I would like to see, within our school curriculum that we have the teaching and the learning of the Windrush generation, the contribution that they made to this country in terms of rebuilding the country. You know, I think it should become very much a part of the standard curriculum basis that people from the Caribbean, British people, they came and they supported this nation and rebuilt the country. That's something which I'd like to see happen. And I also think as well, given the Windrush scandal, that we need to be looking at some real proper payouts to those Windrush generations, some automaticity in terms of these payouts, what they've suffered. Look, money can never repay some of the things that has happened to the Windrush generation, but it can signal an intent in terms of restoring some of that damage. And I think that's something that needs to be, we continue to be campaigning for.
Absolutely. Clive, some fantastic points there. I'm particularly applauding when you said that the Windrush generation and their story needs to be taught in schools. That's something that I'm very, very passionate about in that right now. If people wanted to get in touch with you or they wanted to come down to your church, where can they contact you?
Yeah, you can contact us on our website, which is thepilgrimchurch.org. And you can find out all about the church. And we have a special page called the Windrush Project, all the activities that we're doing. And do email me as well on fostercus@yahoo.com. That's fostercus@yahoo.com. And or check out our website, thepilgrimchurch.org.
Thank you so much. You have been listening to Windrush, What's Next? The Struggle for Justice with me, Sinai Slary, and my special guest, Clive Foster, who is the Senior Minister at Pilgrim Church in Nottingham. Thank you so much, Clive.
No problem.
Windrush, What's Next? The Struggle for Justice in memory of Barlett Wilson.
And my final guest on this episode discussing the Windrush compensation scheme is Hilary Brown.
Thank you for joining me.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
When were you first aware of the Windrush scandal and how did you respond to the number of people being affected in the community?
Well, do you know, I was well aware for many years that people from the Windrush era were being detrimentally affected by the way the immigration rules were written and various casework decisions were coming out. I was aware of it for many, many years. And in fact, I can remember making some robust representations around 2007, 2008 to the Home Office to such an extent that I believe in 2011, the Voice newspaper did quite a piece on why people from the Commonwealth countries were being treated differently from people coming from the European countries. And so I was quite verbal about it, you know, going back as far as 2008.
Right. Now, within your field of work in immigration policy change over the years, do you know, like, which policy in particular hit your clients the most? And what have been some of the worst effects on people's lives that you have seen from the work that you've been doing?
Well, do you know, the situation in relation to clients being so detrimentally affected is not just in relation to immigration rules and policy. It's also in relation to the change in legal aid, where people were no longer able to access legal aid to fight their various cases. But looking at the changes in the immigration rules themselves, when people were expected to be removed and denied the right of an in-country appeal and could only appeal when they were outside of the United Kingdom, had a devastating effect on not only people's abilities to stay in contact with their usually UK-based lawyers to progress the appeal whilst they were abroad, but we saw that many, many people were returned and lost their lives as a result of having to be returned to a country that they perhaps fled from or feared returning to before they were able to exercise an out-of-country right of appeal. And this had a devastating effect and did lots of things that were so wrong, not only affecting clients, but absolutely clogging up the tribunal service, where, you know, people were having to adjourn cases because, you know, the clients weren't contactable or clients weren't able to provide, you know, their signatures on statements. And it was a logistical nightmare.
Yeah. Now, in your experience, like, how many of these clients who, you know, have been deported back to these countries, how many of them have actually led successful appeals to come back to the UK? I mean, is that something that is really common, or is it really, I'm guessing it must be extremely difficult.
Well, do you know, I don't have those statistics, but those statistics are available. Obviously, I would only have the information about the clients that I dealt with. And it is difficult. It is very, very difficult, but not impossible, because, of course, many of those individuals had genuine cases. And yeah. So we were able to return a number of people to the United Kingdom. But I think that was in spite of the restrictions and the difficulties we had to face. And that's only because we had other connections in those countries with people who were able, you know, to help out. I have good working relationships with other law firms in Jamaica, for instance, who would allow, you know, my clients to go into their offices and fax or scan an email documents to me. And so it's only because of those relationships that we've built up were we able to go that extra mile to help our clients. But some of them, I'm absolutely sure, faced impossible logistical hurdles that they just weren't able to overcome.
Yeah, I mean, the government did launch the Windrush Compensation Scheme back in April 2019. I mean, what do you make of the scheme? It's come under great criticism in the media and in the community for being too complicated, for being too slow to pay out money to victims. I mean, what's your opinion on the scheme overall?
I mean, there were a number of issues that I was unhappy about in relation to the consultation process that then led on to the scheme. And the consultation process, there were two different teams. There were the teams that were trying to get people registered so they could get their biometrics residence permit. And then there was the team that tried to consult with the whole of the United Kingdom and get people's views on what the ultimate design of the compensation scheme should look like. And so I heard at around about September, October of last year, of the year before last, that the Home Office were going to, close off the consultation before they had even visited Wales. So how can you have a UK-wide consultation and yet only visit certain capital cities around England? There had been no consultation in Scotland. There had been no consultation in Wales, and there was certainly no consultation in Northern Ireland. So that was one of my first criticisms. And when I found and read that the consultation had actually closed off, you know, I contacted the task force myself and insisted that the scheme be reopened and that the team come to Wales. Thankfully, they did, and they did come to Wales, and they did speak to a number of people, and we were able to register quite a few people who were absolutely desperate, who had no documentation whatsoever to prove that they were here in the United Kingdom with the ability to do things such as access national health treatment. And so that for me was a vital consultation process that could have excluded so many people. The compensation scheme, which is an entirely separate scheme, for me is very frustrating because I see and I hear, I've assisted a number of people myself. It is a very long process. I'm disappointed with the amount of compensation claims that have been granted. And generally, I'm disappointed with the amounts of money people have been given. You know, many of the people have had 30, 40 years of disruption, 30, 40 years of having unnecessary difficulties that were, you know, made worse in the past, you know, during the hostile environment. And I think it's really disappointing that in light of so much evidence of the hardships felt by people caught up in this scandal, and it is a scandal that the compensation rates are so low. I think it's awful.
We've heard so many stories about people finding it difficult to fill out these forms, and we know the government's recently procured organisations to be paid to do applications for Windrush survivors. I mean, is this something your company decided to take part in, and if not, why?
Well, in the first instance, it was expected that the clients themselves should make the applications themselves. And of course, not everybody is able to fill out such complicated forms. And, you know, in the first instance, I was personally disappointed with the fact that the government decided not to give legal aid to already existing practitioners who were expert in this area to allow them to assist people through the legal aid scheme to fill out the various application forms. Because, of course, some of the application forms were extremely onerous, expecting you to provide documentary evidence of documents that have long been destroyed. You know, documentary evidence of historical earnings. And, you know, so it would have been necessary for somebody to, you know, get hold of Inland Revenue or medical records. And sometimes there were cost implications of that. So, you know, it wasn't a case that many of our clients could just fill out the form. And I was then disappointed to see that, well, I was glad in a way that the government had recognized that this was additional work that needed to be remunerated. Somebody needed to be remunerated to do this work. But I personally decided for my firm it wasn't the right fit for us because I wanted my clients to know that we were completely independent of the Home Office. And we made a conscious effort and a conscious decision to stay remote from that procurement process and not go for one of those contracts.
How do you think the Home Office and the government can right the wrongs of the Windrush scandal? What are some of the things you think they can do? I know we had the Lessons Learnt review by Wendy Williams. You know, Priti Patel has made statements saying the Home Office will be, you know, revamped and training will be given so that people are aware of, you know, race and the history of the Windrush generation. Do you think those things will help or do you think there should be more done?
Well, I've been around for an awful long time and I've heard an awful lot of promises. You know, I remember that it's not fit for purpose. And I didn't see any improvements after that. I'm very skeptical. I hope that there is going to be a complete overhaul of the immigration services, the UKVI. I'm not yet convinced that it will happen to the extent that it needs to happen.
People are listening to this right now, and you know, they do have concerns that they might be caught up in the scandal in some way, but they're hesitant to come forward. I mean, is your firm taking on more clients as we speak?
Absolutely. We have, from the very beginning, dealt with every Windrush client on a pro bono basis. Nobody has ever been charged by us. Neither have we had any money from the government or through legal aid. We are committed and prepared to continue to process Windrush applications for biometrics cards and for British citizenship for those who are entitled to it, and we will continue to do so.
That's fantastic. Hilary, I applaud you for your passion and all the work that you're doing regarding this Windrush scandal. Finally, before you go, where can people get in touch with you if they need to, if they want to chat, if they want some advice, or they want you to point them in the right direction of where they can go for help? Where can they get in contact with you?
So we have two offices. We have an office in South Wales, in Barry in South Wales, and the address is 265 Holton Road, Barry. We have an office in Brixton, and the address is 199 Stockwell Road. We have a Facebook page. We have a website, www.virgoconsultancy.org. Our telephone numbers for both offices are set out clearly on all of our social media platforms. We also take walk-in inquiries, and we're happy for people to ring and make appointments. And if they can identify that they are potentially Windrush clients, we're happy to see them as a matter of priority.
That is absolutely wonderful. And I'm sure, hopefully, you know, me speaking to you today will prompt some people who don't want to come forward to actually come forward and seek help. Hilary, it has been fantastic speaking to you today. Do you have any lasting words that you want to say to people who may be listening?
I just wanted to say, please, to anybody who feel that they may be caught up in this hostile environment and this Windrush scandal, don't suffer in silence. There are enough of us around the United Kingdom willing to listen and to help you. Please don't suffer in silence. The consequences of suffering in silence are too great. We've seen people, and we're aware of people who have lost their life because they were too terrified to access the National Health Service.
Thank you so much. You have been listening to Windrush, What's Next? The Struggle for Justice with me, Sinai Flary, and my very special guest, Hilary Brown, who is the CEO at Virgo Consultancy Services Limited. Hilary, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Windrush, What's Next? The Struggle for Justice with me, Sinai Flary, and my special guests, Jacqueline McKenzie, Martin Ford QC, Minister Clive Foster, and Hilary Brown, who were discussing the Windrush compensation scheme. Join me again on the next episode, Oral Histories, where we can listen together to stories from the Windrush generation about the Empire Windrush and honouring their legacy.
The Windrush What's Next series is supported by funds from the Paul Hamlin Foundation.